We have ignition sequence start.
Short distance, high impact.
5, 4, 3, 2, all engines running.
10 questions with Adam Jouar. Big names, great minds.
Make yourself a cup of tea.
Liftoff, we have liftoff.
Welcome to 10 Questions. Thanks for the feedback on the Steve Vizard interview. I really enjoyed putting that one together. And of course, you can contact me on Twitter at The10Questions. Today, I'm interviewing one of Australia's greatest journalists, the host of PM, Mark Colvin. Mark's a graduate of Oxford, a pioneering staff member of 2JJ, which became Triple J. He was one of the first reporters on Nationwide, then became a foreign correspondent in London, was the founding presenter on The World Today, then worked on Four Corners, Foreign Correspondent, Late Line, and the 7:30 Report. And it was when he was in Rwanda for the 7:30 Report that he became ill with a condition that nearly took his life. He talks about that in this interview, as well as the subsequent life-saving treatments he's had over the years, including a kidney transplant. Today, Mark is generous in revealing many dramatic moments in his life, both journalistically and personally, but it really only touches the surface. The rest will be in his memoir that he's taking leave from PM to write. I started by asking Mark when he was most happy.
I think there's a sort of innocent happiness and then there's a kind of grown-up happiness. I think I was very happy when I was a small child. I remember, you know, most of my childhood memories are very happy, even though I was moving around the world and, you know, because my dad was a spook under the cover of being a diplomat. And, you know, in some ways you'd think that would be very confusing and not a very happy experience for a child. But I was happy. For instance, we lived in Kuala Lumpur in a house with a nice big garden that had banana trees down the back and a mangosteen tree in the middle. And I always think of it, and it was beside the Kuala Lumpur race course, and I had learned to ride a pony there, and there was a big swimming pool nearby. And you lived in Kuala Lumpur. When you went to school in Kuala Lumpur, you got up early in the morning, you were home at lunchtime, and the rest of the day was your own. So I used to spend most afternoons, in my memory anyway, I used to spend most afternoons at the pool and or you know, riding a pony or whatever. And that garden with a mangosteen tree always seems a bit like the Garden of Eden to me.
Yeah.
And especially as I was then, you know, sent back at the age of seven, sent back to England where it was very cold to go to a really nasty boarding school. That's a bit like being thrown out the Garden of Eden in some ways. But in adulthood, I don't know. I think the 3 years I spent at what was then called Double J, which is now Triple J, from the founding of, you know, it was a brand new radio station. And it was just huge fun. You just had incredible freedom, and it was what made me into a journalist. I'd been I was a cadet for a year in 1974, and then I went over to Double J in 1975. And the freedom to cover the stuff that you wanted, the freedom to cover stuff that your own generation wanted to cover. All of that. I worked incredibly hard, but made some fantastic friends and had an enormous amount of fun and saw some great music. That was a very happy time. I mean, you know, I haven't had a lot of terribly unhappy times in my life, except, you know, largely, well, apart from being sent off to boarding school, but you know, most of my unhappy times have been caused by ill health and being in hospital and things like that.
Yeah. So,
but, you know, those are probably two good, very good examples of happiness in my life.
I'm a boarding school veteran too, but I didn't go to boarding school at seven. So you went from seven to, what, 18 or?
Yeah, the first 5 years were the worst because I was at a really nasty Dickensian place. And then I went to a much nicer place in London where half the kids were day boys, and the rest of us were mostly weekly boarders. And my mother was living in London, and so I was 10 minutes away on bus ride if I needed to nip home and get something, you know.
Yeah.
So that was that was good. But the 5 years of complete isolation, especially the first few years when my parents were on the other side of the world, and so there was never even any thought that you could run away and,
that's
and
amazing.
Just, you know, be done with the whole thing. That was tough, yeah.
That is extraordinary, at the age of seven being sent to the other side of the world to some horrible English boarding school.
It's lonely, and I think I was quite angry about it. I got into a lot of fights. I was beaten. I was beaten pretty constantly for the first couple of terms, and you know, to some of that was my fault, if you like, because I think I was reacting very badly. I used to flail around and thrash around and get into fights with other boys, but that was because I was just, you know, incredibly lonely and confused mainly.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know, you read Harry Potter or watch the Harry Potter films, and they're all piling onto the school train. That's the bit that always annoys me. You know, the school train was just associated with the feeling of utter dread for me.
Yeah. For me, it was the plane from Cairns to Brisbane. We'd all get on in our different uniforms and all looking quite miserable.
Yeah, I remember flying back a few times on your own. They used to put this label around your neck, a bit like Paddington Bear, that said VYP, very young passenger, and they looked after you very well. But I it was quite a strange experience, you know, going first the plane and then a relative would meet you at the other end and then it'd be the school train and that was no fun. And also being dropped off on a Sunday evening after one of the rare weekends out, that can still bring a sense of dread to the bottom of my stomach, you know.
Question two, who would you like to apologise to and why?
I think I'd like to apologise to the people that I have sort of left in my trail. I mean, we all do this, I think. You know, you move on. In my case, I've moved so much from country to country and sometimes I haven't been as good as I should have been about keeping up connections with people. I'm a bad letter writer, and you know, an awful lot of my travel comes from the pre-Skype era, the pre-cheap phone call era, all of that. And it was harder to keep in touch. I'm not making excuses, really, but you know, cut connections with people that I'm very fond of. On the other hand, you know, the great friendships are the ones that just take up where they left off. I had spent a day the other day with an old friend I hadn't seen for a very long time, and it was just like taking it up where we left off. You know, it was as if we had seen each other yesterday. You know, so it's really easy to just get onto the hamster wheel, especially now in the Twitter era. You know, I'm off writing a book now, and I'm really trying to break the habit, but you know, I spend an enormous amount of time when I'm not working just trawling the net looking for stories. Basically, my job is to be across everything. Anything that happens shouldn't surprise me too much, and they should be able to throw a live interview at me at any time. I think that's basically my job, really. So I do an enormous amount of broad reading right across the board, and I have Twitter kind of in the corner of my eye almost all the time, just waiting for anything big to break and so forth. So it's actually, yeah, you can just get completely caught up in the moment, really.
Twitter really does play into the journalist's instincts.
Oh, absolutely. It's an incredible tool for journalism too. You know, there's so many times when I have either got contacts or ideas or got in contact with people or helped other colleagues get in contact with people. If you've got a lot of followers, you can use it as a crowdsourcing system. You know, you can check facts. You can get people will just happily send you quite abstruse documents or whatever. If you're researching a story, it's quite an incredible thing like that. Also, it has this amazing effect. I think it measurably boosts the profile of the program that I do PM, and it also gives people the sense that you are not maybe you're not just, you know, a newsreader, just a newsreader. You know what I mean? That you are actually a proper journalist, and the program has something to do with you.
Question three. What is your greatest regret?
Look, I keep thinking about this, and honestly, my feeling about this is that you can't have regrets. No. I think because I've had so many weird things happen in my life that I would, if I was the regretting type, I would think, oh God, I wish I could go back and change that. Mm. You know, a lot of things that have happened to me, and obviously, you know, the last 20 years of my life have been dominated by chronic disease one way or another. You know, I went to, so I could say to you, oh God, I wish I hadn't gone to Rwanda and got the illness that triggered the immune system disease that, you know, or I could say, but it's like that game about, you know, if you could go back and kill Hitler, would you do that? Or if you could go back and stop Hitler being stop Hitler's parents meeting, would you do that? There's a great Stephen Fry novel in which somebody does that and they go back and change history. And then it turns out that somebody even worse than Hitler takes over in Germany, and Germany wins the war, you know. So in a way, I just think you just got to keep pushing forward. I find when I do look back, it probably gets me, you know, leads me a little bit towards depression. So I avoid it largely. And I think, as I say, regret is not a constructive emotion. You know, the regret about the things that have happened to you, or the different ways your life might have gone. You know, I could have not become a journalist at all, or I could have become a English academic, and my life could have been completely different. But it is what it is, and you deal with what you've got, I think. Deal with the hand that you dealt.
Question four, what you still need to do to feel you've lived a satisfactory life?
Well, this question's a bit related to the last one, in that I think because I very, very nearly died in 1994. I got this illness, and it put me in hospital, I was hemorrhaging from the lungs and hemorrhaging from the stomach, and I was in more or less intensive care for months and months. I was in hospital altogether for 6 months.
Wow.
And it damaged my kidneys, and I was told back then that looking at the averages, I probably would only have about 10 years to live. And I had a series of relapses of the disease, and then in 2004 I had a really bad relapse which none of the drugs were dealing with, and then I had the incredible good fortune to get a new drug, a monoclonal antibody that I was the first person in Australia to be given, and it worked. And so I've had another, you know, more than decade of life. And then in 2013, I got a new kidney, and, you know, so many great things have happened in that way. But what I'm saying is that I learned quite a long time ago that I might only have quite a short time to live. And so I've lived it one day at a time. I've tried to live as well as I can, enjoy myself as much as I can, spend as much time with my children as I can. I say children, they're adult boys now, adult men now. But, if I died tomorrow, I'll be prepared for it, and I wouldn't, again, have any regrets, you know. And then, you know, but before that, I had the most fantastically adventurous life, you know, and working for the ABC as a foreign correspondent, I went all over Europe. I met extraordinary people. You know, I covered the Solidarity uprising in Poland, and I covered the revolution in Tehran, the hostage crisis. I covered the whole, you know, Reagan-Gorbachev thaw in the 1980s as Brussels correspondent. I've done an awful lot of work in Italy and France and Spain and places like that. You know, I've had great travel. I've worked at Four Corners in Africa, Southeast Asia, America, all over the place, and met amazing people and done amazing things. You know, I had a good life on the road. I do, you know, that's the, going back to the regret question, that's the thing I regret most about my current life is that I can't travel. I'm physically quite disabled and I can't, you know, I would love to be the, I'd love to be in a position where I could go to Paris, for instance, you know, during the last week or two, because I speak good French and I was covering those issues about Muslim migrants in Paris during the 1980s and the 1990s. And I sort of understand the situation I would have been able to contribute something. And so you have those situations where you think, oh, you know, I wish I could be out there. That's the thing. I'm a good reporter and I enjoy transmuting what I see and hear into a written or filmed or broadcast story. So there's something slightly frustrating about sitting in the studio. And I tend to use the correspondence as a bit of a sort of proxy for my own eyes and ears in that way, I think.
After you've been on the road and after you've been covering the stories that you've covered, just going back to ordinary life it's like you're a former addict or something.
Literally, you keep your passport in your jacket pocket or your trouser pocket all the time, just in case, you know.
Wow.
When you're a correspondent, you know, you're just constantly... And that you have that thing, a bit like when you have your first child and you spend all night, kind of half sleep in case that, you know, you're always kind of slightly, as a correspondent, you're always slightly on edge in case. Because, you know, I remember being rung at 3 o'clock in the morning and told from Sydney that the Swedish Prime Minister, Olof Palme, had been shot in Stockholm. This is back in the 80s. And, you know, literally just jumping into my clothes and getting on the phone, organising things, going to the airport and arriving in Stockholm at dawn, more or less, and things like that. You keep you constantly sort of on the alert and keep you... And then, you know, you come back here and you're just, as I say, going into the office, it's very creative work, you know. It's great work, but it's not the same. It's not the same as getting out there with a tape recorder or with a film crew. I miss the collaboration too. I miss the sense that you have of working with a cameraman, camerawoman, producer, and finding, you know, that you're working with people and with editors for that matter, film editors. Working with people who add more than you imagined be there in the story, you know.
Question five is, who is the person who most influenced you and how?
Well, obviously, your parents influence you very strongly. My father was a very, really remarkable man, very, very intelligent, very mercurial, quite sort of glamorous in some ways. He wasn't James Bond, but he wasn't George Smiley either. He wasn't a little, you know, he was extremely well-read, very, very smart. I remember when I was at school and, you know, you had friends who would spout rubbish about Marxism and my father was not only capable of arguing with them, he would sort of quote passages of Marx at them, revealing that they actually hadn't read any Marx. You know, he was that. And plus, this was during the Vietnam War, and he was actually the British Consul General in Hanoi. Wow. During the worst of the bombing, Operation Rolling Thunder.
Wow.
But we had a fairly turbulent relationship, and I wish I'd spent more time with him than I had. You know, we were often on opposite sides of the world, him being in his field and me being in my field, and my mother being Australian and me coming out here to live, because my parents split up when I was about 11. And actually, my mother is an incredible woman as well. She is still, at the age of 90, managing a farm with extreme efficiency and raising cattle on the southern tablelands and reading prolifically and, you know, really interesting stuff that she loves to talk about. So I think my parents have been a very, very good influence, both remarkably intelligent and challenging people.
Does your mum listen to the show?
Oh, yeah. She's a great ABC listener, yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Question six, when was the last time you cried and why?
Oh, I cry quite a lot. I think I'm not one of those people who goes off into a corner to cry. You'll see tears streaming down my face while I'm watching a movie or whatever. But the last time I cried, I was definitely the weekend of, you know, when I saw the Paris killings, and it was not only because of the obvious reasons, just the dreadful carnage of it. It was also because it was so close to home. Not only because I know Paris so well and spent so much time there, but also because when my youngest son, who's now 25, when he was about 16, he went off to Europe and on his first kind of big trip on his own. We went to London and stayed with relatives and hung out and went to concerts and things. And he actually hopped on the train and went across to Paris and spent a couple of days. I think he went to see Mastodon in Paris, you know. And it's exactly the same thing, you know. That could have been one of my sons, who are both into music and both could easily have been there watching the Eagles of Death Metal.
Yeah.
You know, it's just and you see those faces and you see those stories of those people. They are us, they're our kids, they're our brothers and sisters and so forth. I don't discount deaths anywhere else. Sorry, I got very dry enough. I don't discount deaths anywhere else, but there is something about the places that you know and the faces of people who are kind of like you, you know, do the things that your kids do, that does really bring a tear to the eye in that way.
Absolutely. Question seven, Mark, what is your current state of mind?
Oh, pretty good, actually. I'm on long service leave. I've been on long service leave for a month and a half or so. I'm writing a book, and so it's a memoir. So my current state of mind is very reflective, but pretty cheerful and very engaged. I'm thinking a lot. I'm constantly, because when you write, my way of writing is to kind of organize quite large amounts of material in my head before I actually write it down. Like I'll start a chapter when I've got the chapter pretty much ready in my head. So there's this constant thing going on in my head, and I've been doing a lot of research on some of my ancestors, and so that's been quite interesting and complicated, and I've got to make a few decisions about how to weave together the stories of different ancestors on the two sides of the family. So there's a lot of kind of quite complex stuff going on in my head, but I'm very much at peace at the moment. I'm in the country, and providing there are no big bushfires around about, everything's pretty peaceful, and it's pretty good, yeah.
And when do you go back on air, by the way?
February.
February, okay. Question eight is, what do you consider your greatest achievement?
Really hard, isn't it? It's one of those things where you go, well, you know, you could choose a bunch of stuff, like working for 5 years at Four Corners. And I know that the first two or three stories that I did at Four Corners were really, you know, I look at them and I think, oh, God, that was awful. And then my last couple of years at Four Corners, stuff you've done a long, long time ago, and that's 25 years ago now, you get it out with some trepidation. Is this actually going to be any good? And then you start watching and you think, my God, I could write a script, didn't I? I really wasn't too bad.
Yeah.
So, you know, learning to write a 45-minute documentary and learning the whole art of long-form TV storytelling. But actually, I think the real answer is that I've got two sons who I have a very good relationship with and who know that they can call me at any time, talk to me about anything, and the kind of patriarchal sense of previous generations is pretty much erased. I don't think they feel that I'm a kind of authority figure. They just think of me as a friend. I think that's an achievement.
That is an achievement. What did they do?
Oh, they've both got bands. They both direct videos. The eldest one's a trained animator. They, you know, people have what they call portfolio careers now, don't they? They don't get into something for life. They put together a bunch of stuff. They're both poor as church mice as a result of it, because they put most of their money into their bands. And the oldest one, they're both songwriters too. The oldest one is called Nick, and he's the lead singer of a band called Deep Sea Arcade.
Okay.
And the youngest one's got a band called Hedge Fund, which is a hilarious title when you know how much of my money and his goes gets sunk into it.
That's fantastic. this is my favourite question. Who would you want on your side in a battle, and why?
I'm going to go with Ulysses, because of I love that. I love the, you know, of all the classical literature, I love the Odyssey best. And the guy is so, you know, he's not the greatest fighter in the world. He's not the strongest. He's not the person who goes out and like Achilles, who goes and fights Hector. He's the wily one. He's the one who works out the tricks. And then basically the reason I'd have him on my side is because he had so many battles. You know, the whole of the Odyssey is really a series of battles to get home. The whole story is trying to get back across the Aegean, not knowing if his wife's going to be alive at the other end, not knowing, and he has to do it all with his brain, really. You know, there's an enormous amount of stuff that has to be done, not with brawn but with brain. And so I reckon we know there was a Troy of some sort. Was there a siege of Troy? We don't really know too much about that. So, you know, is he a real figure or a mythological figure? But whichever he is, I like him, and I like the, you know, there's a great poem by Tennyson about him. There's a great poem by Louis MacNeice about him. James Joyce turned his entire story into a story about a bloke wandering around Dublin. You know, he's endlessly fascinating, I think.
And the final question, what would you like your last words to be?
I love the last words, the whole last words thing. You know, there's so many great stories about people's last words. You know, I think it was Pitt the Younger, or I can't remember if it was Pitt the Elder or Pitt the Younger, was expected to say something really, really interesting on his deathbed, and actually what he said was, "Bring me a Bellamy's pork pie.
Yes,
Whereas Goethe, the poet Goethe, actually did say, which I think is the most beautiful set of last words that anyone has ever said, more light, more light.
Wow.
Which is like, you know, it's so poetic, it's extraordinary. And then there are the sort of the great stories about the made up ones, like George the Fifth, I think, was said they put out a press release or whatever they did in those days, saying that George the Fifth's last words were, "How is the Empire?" But what he actually said was, the doctors were telling him that it would be good for him to go to Bognor Regis. Because he might get better if he got some sea air. And his last words were, "Bugger Bognor." But I think my favourite last words, and I think I'll adopt them, are the actor John LeMessurier, you know, who was Sergeant Wilson in Dad's Army and was in lots of the Ealing comedies and was with Tony Hancock here. And his last words were, "It's all been rather lovely."
We have ignition sequence start.
Short distance, high impact.
5, 4, 3, 2, all engines running.
10 questions with Adam Zwar. Big names, great minds.
Make yourself a cup of tea.
Liftoff, we have liftoff.